Hi, I'm the Dark Tangent, and you're about to listen to some speeches from DEFCON 2, held at the Sahara Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1994, July 22nd to the 24th. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, the Dark Tangent and DEFCON Communications, all rights reserved, except permission is granted for educational nonprofit use. Now, the Sahara, like most other hotels DEFCON's been at, has since been blown up to make way for a bigger and better hotel. So with that in mind, sit back, relax, get ready for some good speeches.
State senators, even possibly your senator for the United States, where you can call them up, they'll know who you are, and they'll listen to you. It basically makes you a voice for 1,000 or so people. If you want to do that, just contact your party headquarters, whichever party you want to be part of. Very simple. Are we set? Jeff? Are we going? Okay. Tell you what, I'm going to give the virus awards after I talk here. First, I'm going to talk about how to get a good laugh when the feds show up at your door. Past couple weeks, I've been in Nigeria, of all places, doing some business kind of stuff there, but had kind of an interesting hack take place that you might be interested in hearing about. Over there, telephone calls are very expensive. It costs about $10 a minute to call the United States. Now you got to remember, not only does it cost $10 a minute, we're talking about a country where kind of a medium-scale job, say a secretary or something like that, may earn only $12 a month. So $10 a minute there is kind of like $1,500 a minute here. So there's some serious incentive to hack. Now, most of it is low-tech hacking. So, I want to call the United States, tell my wife I made it over there safely, which is not a small thing. And so, my friend takes me to the president's house in Jos. He has a friend there who's kind of in charge of operations of this house, which the president of the country maintains, you know, in that city. So if he ever goes there, or you know, if a high official goes there, they have a nice place to stay. The nice thing about that is that the telephone company, Nitel, is owned by the government. So the government doesn't have to pay any telephone bills. So you can go in there and use the phone for free. So anyhow, I go there, use the phone. As a matter of fact, the commissioner of Nitel had been there that day, and he had just left before I got there. And it was also about supper time, so they decided that they would give me his dinner, since they didn't know where he was. Now, in Nigeria, there's kind of a pecking order where anybody who's at a lower level basically acts like a servant to anybody who's at a higher level. And they treated me like I was, you know, somebody very important. So they take me into the president's dining room. You know, they've got gold trim on the tables and everything, and serve me this dinner on state, you know, silverware and everything. And then they all leave. They don't sit down and eat with you. They go off in the kitchen or wherever to eat. So I'm sitting there. Okay, now you got to understand, Nigeria is a military dictatorship. Last fall, they had an election. The old president decided he didn't really like the new guy who got elected. So instead of letting him become president, he was arrested. Okay. Of course, the United States complains about this because the United States doesn't like it when people do that, those kind of things. And the president of the country basically told him to go shove off. They're not real keen on American citizens over there right now. I'm sitting there in the president's dining room in his military dictatorship eating the commissioner's dinner, and nobody's there. crazy. I say all this because the point I want to make is that a lot of times Americans take the law too seriously. And sometimes it's really valuable for us to look at government as just like another business. And the law is really an attempt to monopolize the marketplace. I think when you do that, that gives you a more realistic assessment of what they can and can't do. And it also gets your focus off of morality. Okay, this past few days I've seen a lot of people who are upset over the export of crypto and the regulations on it. I mean, we expect the government to do what's right, to be moral in our sense of morality, whatever that may be. Okay, and most Americans look at that export law and say, well, there's something wrong here, you know, because we have an idea of freedom of speech and we ought to be free to do those kind of things. But if you look at it as a business, well, they're trying to monopolize the marketplace. They want to be in charge, sure. And, you know, they want to dictate prices. They want to dictate what you can and can't get. And that's pretty natural for a business. You see businesses do that a lot. I think of disposable diapers. When I had my first kid, you know, you got 65 diapers in a package. They were nice, thick diapers that worked really well. Well, now I've had my third kid, and you get 50 diapers in a package. They're real thin, and they don't work very well. You know, the businesses lie to you and say, well, these are thinner, more absorbent diapers. But they're not, and they don't work very well. I gotta buy them, because that's all there is. I mean, really, the crypto issue is a whole lot like diapers. I hate to say it. But it is. I get mad at the diaper company, you know, but on the other hand, it's not the same kind of moral indignation that you get mad at the government with. So if you step back and look at the government more like the diaper company, sometimes you're a whole lot better off. I mean, the Nigerians, they have this down. They'll do something like that to me, you know, and they don't think anything of it. They think it's just, you know, they're trying to be kind to me and treat me with respect. I mean, realistically, if you brought one of my friends from Nigeria here, they would probably be categorized as a right-wing fundamentalist Christian. I mean, that's where they're at. But on the other hand, they'll go to the black markets in an instant. You know, they have no qualms about it whatsoever. For example, when you go over there, you get to the airport, they want to see what kind of American dollars you got, because they want to transform your currency into theirs at a special fixed rate, okay, which is like 22.5 to 1. Now, you don't tell them what currency you've got. Then you go into the country, and your friend takes you to the guy downtown. The guy downtown will change it 50 to 1. I mean, this is just the way of life for these people. It's a way of life. And, you know, the government passes some law like that, they just say, so what? Do what we can do. Here in America, I think we take that law too seriously. Okay. I think we all kind of realize that there's a real revolution going on with microcomputers. It's causing a revolution in society. I think this revolution is going to absolutely blow away big government. And you've got to see that this revolution is changing things at a very deep level, even deeper than the level at which, you know, we might think and justify things. Already it's made a lot of laws anachronisms. And I might say this, that right now I'm not here to argue for government or against government. I'm merely looking at it as an observer and saying, well, it seems like this is what's happening. I'm not trying to make it happen necessarily, but it's happening, and really it's going to happen. Look at the copyrights, for example. Right now, the FTA is dancing for you. You know, they come up with all these jingles, you know, don't copy that floppy and stuff like that. They're dancing. Trying to entertain you and trying to, you know, teach you some of their morals by doing that and entertaining you. A long time ago, a copyright law used to make a lot of sense. I mean, you had to go out and, you know, get a book typeset and print it on a big printer. And it didn't make a whole lot of sense to run more than a few thousand copies. For somebody else to go out and do that and steal your work, yeah, you know, you could stop them. Copy machines came along. Finally, floppy disks came along. And it's just completely changed the scene where the copyright laws don't really even make sense. Now, I kind of look at the FPA as dancing with a spear in their hand. In other words, they threaten you along with the dance. But it's a spear in a gunpowder world. They try to scare you. They try to intimidate you. And they also try to indoctrinate you. Really, they can't enforce the law, though, when it comes right down to it. Right now, if any two people in this room wanted to exchange software, they could do so without any more fear than fear of walking outside and being struck by a meteor. Really? Really? I mean, if you do it right, I mean, you can take that KOH program back there and duplicate a couple of floppies without ever having a plain text copy of it. How are they going to ever stop you? They can't. So essentially, that law, it's an anachronism. It's unenforceable, and you know, by and large, people can't ignore it. Now, like I said, they like to indoctrinate you, teach you that, well, copying a floppy is stealing. Is it? I can't find that anywhere in my Bible. I mean, I can find it, you know, find stealing, sure, but that's where, you know, somebody goes in and takes something that belongs to somebody else. Somebody else no longer has that thing. So, I mean, you're really talking invented morality. You could go out and invent a different morality. I saw in 2600 a very interesting little letter from a guy in the Philippines. He said, gee, I see this whole copying issue is kind of like Jesus with the loaves, you know, how he multiplied the loaves and multiplied the fishes and fed 5,000 people. I mean, using the FPA's argument, hey, Jesus was robbing the fishermen and robbing the bakers of their just wage, wasn't he? There are a lot of ways to think about these things, and we can't swallow what some... I mean, FPA is not even the government, okay? There's some, you know, trade organization, basically. So let's not swallow anything too quickly. I think one of the bottom lines for what's going to happen, I mean, we see these laws being simply made useless. One of the bottom lines is what's written on the t-shirts that we had for this conference. Why? Because I can. If you can do something, there are a lot of people who will do it. That's just a fact of life. If it's something good, fine. If it's something bad, that's fine too. People will do it. They'll try it. And I think their morality is going to change to fit the situation a lot of times. I look at the gunpowder revolution, which, you know, was 500 years ago. That changed people's morality in a lot of ways. For example, the relationship between men and women. Right now, we treat women more as equals than they did hundreds of years ago. A lot of that is because a woman can carry a gun. Really? really, I mean, it sets her at an equal level in society in a lot of ways. The old saying in the West here is, you know, God made men, cult made them equal. It's true. In Nigeria, things are not like that. I mean, the women are like servants down here somewhere. They don't eat with their husbands unless their husband calls them in. They feed their husband and serve him, and then they go back in the kitchen and eat. They don't go to bed with their husband unless he calls her in. You're walking somewhere, doing something. It's the woman's job to carry everything. I mean, I was walking to the taxi to go to the airport, and my friend's wife has got my briefcase in her hand and my suitcase on her head. You know, I couldn't take them away from her. I offer, and it's like, no, got it. Very different. And I think that, you know, you can see how morality has changed over the years, but you look at the influences and why that's happened. And I think it's going to change with the microcomputer revolution too. Basically, what happens is there's a shift in the power equation. What the power equation is you look at how much money does it cost to project power, how much money does it cost for the government to enforce their laws, versus how much money does it cost to resist. Okay, it's becoming easier and easier to resist. I mean, we see this in the law enforcement community today. They're pretty good at you know, taking care of the common usual crimes, but I mean, you start defrauding a bank electronically or something like that, and they get lost real quick. You've got to be pretty expert in what's going on in the computer scene in order to figure out who's defrauding a bank and how. I think people don't really realize the impact that this revolution is going to have right now. There seems to be a certain realization point that comes with these kind of major revolutions. For example, like I said, the gunpowder revolution really occurred about 500 years ago. Really exactly 500 years ago. Gunpowder had been around Europe for a while. Then in 1494 something happened. The French went to fight with an Italian city-state. And for centuries upon centuries, the way to defend a city is to build big walls around it. You build big walls around a city, close the gates, and it's pretty much impenetrable by middle-age standards. But in 1494, the French army did something new. They brought cannons. And within 8 hours, that wall was rubble. And from that time on, people knew that something had changed. They saw that they're going to have to live their lives differently. We really haven't had that happen yet. I think we're going to see it. I don't know what form it's going to take. I think we could have seen it in the Gulf War, but I think it's going to be more of a revolution towards the resistance, since it's becoming cheaper and cheaper to resist power. Going over to the Gulf was an incredibly expensive thing for the United States. They practically couldn't afford it. Well, they couldn't afford it. Had to have other governments chipping in and everything else. It's only getting more expensive as time goes on. On the other hand, the possibility of resistance, the cost keeps going down and down and down. Think about this. Suppose one day you were watching TV, CNN or whatever, and here's the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Japan in the Rose Garden, ready to sign a new trade agreement and, you know, bring peace on the trade front between the two countries. All of a sudden, five drones about the size of a small bird come down. And within seconds, both ministers are, you know, the prime minister and the president, both laying on the ground, dying, poisoned by these drones. I mean, that kind of a scene is possible today. And no one would know where they came from. No one would know who did it. Nothing. It's entirely possible. I mean, what happens when anybody with a little bit of technical expertise can simply liquidate any government official that they don't like and never get caught? I mean, what that's going to do is it's going to absolutely destroy any possibility of big government. It will. So, where are we today? I think you've got a lot to laugh about when the feds come. I mean, right now, long term, they're losers. I don't think the system can hold together. I mean, government can't even really project its power very well today. Hard criminals know this. I mean, they're not afraid. They'll go out and rob or steal or whatever. And they know that, you know, their average time in prison is going to be about 4 minutes per crime. And they're willing to pay the price. The LA rioters knew it. They knew it. And what happens? I mean, the government gets into this appeasement policy with them. You know, they couldn't convict the cops, so they put them in double jeopardy. Oh, yeah. And then they convict them because they're afraid of another riot. They start pouring money into the neighborhood. I mean, that's basically appeasement. We got to know it, too. Those are areas where the government is really fairly effective when it comes right down to it. They know how to deal with those kind of things. If you're a cyber professional today, I mean, you are living at the edge of an anarchy, really. Really. There are three things that you got to look at, okay? Number one, they cannot take the tools of your trade. This is a very unique situation. I mean, what are the tools of your trade? Number one, it's your information, your software. Okay, your work. The hardware is really very minimal. I mean, yeah, you got to go out and pay $1,000, $2,000 for a computer. But you can buy one of those anywhere in the world, anytime. It's your software. It's really important. You can copy it. I mean, I've got 1 2-gigabyte DAT tape that's got everything I've ever done on it, computer-wise. Everything. And a whole lot more stuff besides. If I can have that tape someplace, I'm in business. Okay? So you make a few copies and crypto. Make sure that tape stays private. Somebody takes that thing, so what? Number two, they can't get at your money unless you let them. Now, most people are pretty dumb about this. They put their money just right there where the feds can come and take it, where anybody who's a little lawsuit happy can come and take it. I'll tell you something about this in a few minutes. Okay, finally, yourself. Okay, they can't get you if you plan a bit. Chances are they won't. I mean, generally the procedure is for them to come in and, you know, they'll take your hardware and software and everything like that, and they'll maybe take you down to the station and book you. But they're going to let you out on bail. So those three things, I think, any software professional is really in a very good position. Well, I want to talk about things you can do defensively to improve your position and things you can do offensively. Defensively, you cover the tools of your trade. Okay, a farmer can't do this, you know, an auto mechanic really can't do this, but a software professional can. You back it up, use crypto, get a scanner. You can scan all your paper documents into your computer. Throw them away, anything that's important. Do the same thing with that then. Now, one thing you got to watch out for is, you know, if you've got everything encrypted, they might put some muscle on you to give them the keys. Alexander Solzhenitsyn had the solution for that, I think, back in the days of old Soviet Union when they would come knocking on your door at midnight. They would, of course, interrogate people and try and get as much information out of them as possible as to, you know, who they're involved with and stuff like that. Solzhenitsyn said, if you get picked up, you become the most forgetful man in the whole world. What's your key? Well, gee, I change my keys every week, and that was 3 weeks ago. I do not remember. What are they going to do? Okay. A lot of us are pretty up on that kind of thing. You know, we encrypt things when necessary in this room. I think a lot of us aren't too up on covering your assets. You know, they come in and take things, they can, you know, get a handle in your bank account. Put a lien on your house if you got one, so on and so forth. So I want to talk about that a little bit. Some of you may not have a whole lot of assets that you need to worry about right now, but you will. So you might want to consider some of these things. There are two things you can look at. There are invisible assets and visible assets. A visible asset is, you know, your house, your car, stuff like that. Invisible assets are basically monetary instruments, a bank account, you know, a mutual fund, whatever. As far as the invisible assets go, it would really make sense to have those in a different country than where you live and work. There are some nice information here that I have that will help you out if you're interested in these kind of things. Here's one nice little book called The Offshore Nest Egg Strategy. Okay? Tells you how to open a foreign account, how to maintain it. You can't buy stuff like this in the United States. If anybody in the U.S. were to publish this book, they would be immediately audited by the IRS. Immediately. But you can get it from Privacy Reports Incorporated at 26A Peel Street, ground floor, Central Hong Kong. 26A Peel Street, P-E-E-L. It's ground floor, Central Hong Kong. Cost 50 cents to mail a letter to them. Just ask them for information on tax havens and whatnot. Privacy Reports Incorporated. Another great one, which you can also get from these guys, 218 tax havens. How to beat the system and keep what you earn. very to the point, it goes through all these different countries, 218 countries. I think they have a new edition out with 225 countries. And it basically tells you, you know, what the financial situation is in just about any country on the face of the earth. Anyway, you know, you can open a bank account in a country like this very easily. And banks in these countries are usually much more flexible than banks in the United States. Typically, they act as a, you know, bank brokerage house. You know, they'll buy precious metals. Just about anything you want to do financially, they can do it. They'll buy bonds, you name it. So, in that sense, you can put any extra money that you've got in a foreign account, and essentially, the United States government cannot touch that money at all. The only way they can deal with it is to go to that country and file a lawsuit. And if you're doing something that's illegal in that country, then maybe they'll get their hands on the money. But I don't know if you remember old Ferdinand Marcos from the Philippines. He had money stashed in foreign bank accounts all over this place. And after he died, the United States government tried to get their hands on that money, because presumably he pilfered it out of payments that the U.S. was making in the Philippines. Well, they still haven't gotten their hands on any of the money, as far as I know. So it's very, very, very difficult. You can operate an account like that just as easily as you can in the United States. You can send them American checks. You can get a Visa card from them, which is really a debit card to your account, and you can spend the money anywhere. This is really completely legal, too, in the States. You do have to report your interest and stuff like that on taxes to stay legal, but you can do that. If you want to dig into that more, you can also go down to your local library. Usually they have a big fat book of banks from all over the world. You can open it up and look through it, you know, after you've read one of these books, and pick some banks, write them letters, they'll open an account for you through the mail. Yeah. Usually got to send them a letter of reference, you know, let them know that you're not a drug dealer or something trying to launder money, but it's no big deal, really. There are legal structures for your visible assets, which make it very difficult for people to get a hold of them. I won't get into that a whole lot. I don't think most of you have, you know, a lot of things like that that you've got to worry about right now. I might mention this one book here called How to Achieve Personal and Financial Privacy in a Public Age by Mark Nestman. I'll give you a phone number you can call to get that. I don't really know how much it costs right now. It's probably in the $50 price range. The company name is LPP Limited. Their phone number is 800-528-0559 or 702-885-2509. But this is a more, you know, more legal ways of doing things in the United States. You know, if you need to protect assets, things like that, you might want to start there. If anybody's really interested, I know some other things. They're pretty expensive, by about $500. But it would be good to look at if you have that kind of money that you need to worry about. Finally, you cover your person. Take opportunities to go overseas and make friends. Take those opportunities. There's a con in Argentina in October. How many people are planning on going? Go. Spend the money. It's worth it. Might cost you, you know, $700 for airfare, but I couldn't think of a better investment. Really. Once you start doing this, you can start start being a customer for different governments. You know, you're not the captive customer anymore. A lot of you are right now, really. Basically, you're here and you got to live here. So when the government does something bad, it's like really upsetting. But when you start seeing yourself as more of a customer for this government, that government, you know, what can this guy do for me and what can that guy do for me? It's like, well, if they're going to screw up, that's their own problem. You know, I hear people talk about, you know, this international cyber culture that transcends national borders and things like that. I mean, how do you join it? This is how you join it. I mean, I can take my business and go anywhere in the world and be back in business in a week. Head in that direction. Okay? Those are defensive strategies. As far as offensive action goes, there's things you can do here. Phil back there needs help developing a voice crypto system. I think that's a great idea. I mean, as far as you know, disempowering the large government bureaucracy. If you can do some assembly language, I could use your help. We've got the KOH program working in good shape now. That'll protect your hard disk. But we'd like to do some things concerning backups. If you got a backup tape and, you know, some assembly language experience, talk to me. I'd like to talk to you about doing some development work on that, where we can start to put together a complete system that's really pretty good, pretty private. So anyhow, I think there are lots of things that you can do to get a good laugh when the feds come. They come knocking, sure, they're intimidating and everything else, but really, in a lot of ways, they can be a paper tiger. Okay. Let's do virus creation wards. Basically, we had a little contest here that ruffled a lot of feathers, I'll tell you. Well, we wanted it to, yeah. Makes life more interesting. We announced a contest where you could write a politically incorrect virus and had some criteria. One was originality. Your virus had to be an original work. One was creativity. I said, make us laugh, make us cry. Amaze us with how bits and bytes can say something about politics and issues. Functionality, the virus has to work. If it only works on some machines or under some versions of DOS or whatnot, then that will count against you. But the better it is at infecting systems and moving around, the better off you will be. So, for example, if you write a file infector, make sure it can jump directories and so on. Political incorrectness. Since computer viruses are politically incorrect, the message should be too. If you send us a pro-establishment virus, then you will not win this contest. A word to the wise. Think about what's correct and what's not. Many positions are only superficially incorrect, though they are really quite fashionable among the establishment. Look at it this way. If you could get a well-written letter expressing your view published in a big city newspaper, then it's not sufficiently incorrect. There are a lot of ideas that are unofficially censored by society, especially the media and academia. They tend to make themselves out to be the rebels, but they are really the establishment. If you can think of anything creatively incorrect and sufficiently obnoxious, if you can't think of anything creatively incorrect and sufficiently obnoxious, then you shouldn't be writing viruses in the first place. Okay? And we also discourage destructive activity in the virus. However, we did not consider damaging or modifying antivirus programs to be destructive activity. Well, I was kind of disappointed with the results that we got from the contest. The media seemed to gobble it up. That one line about not being able to get a letter published in a big city newspaper really set them off. That's all I can say. I mean, we made the worldwide edition of the New York Times. I was surprised, but we did. Anyhow, it was a hard decision. I got one really legitimate entry for the contest called the Pro-AL virus, which Pro-AL, pro-artificial life. It really wasn't very politically incorrect, I have to say. Then there was this other virus, which somebody suggested, and I thought it was a great idea, but nobody really implemented it. It was called the tax break virus. Now, you know that you can submit returns to the IRS electronically now, and there's a data record and everything that's designed to submit. Well, this virus would theoretically go around and look for those records and modify them for you to give you a tax break. And let you send them in. And then about April 16th, pop up and say, "Hey, I gave you a tax break." Now, somehow I thought that if somebody would actually implement that virus, probably would be illegal to implement. I think that one might be illegal. But if somebody were to do that, I think it might actually spread accidentally on purpose, if you know what I mean. Finally, we had one rather unusual virus that wasn't really submitted, but it was a result of the contest, so I really kind of consider it to be a submission. I'll just take it that way. Back around April Fool's Day, the National Computer Security Association held a conference in Washington. I say April Fool's Day for a reason. And they were really ticked off about the contest. And they're holding meetings trying to figure out what to do about it. You know, should they try and sue me? Should they go and lobby Congress to get legislation passed? Should they ignore it? So anyhow, I kind of realized Fred Cohn, in his recent book called It's Alive, talked about a virus called a meme, and this affects human brains. And I realized that here was the makings of a new virus. It's called the Don Quixote. Some people call it paranoia, some people call it contest too. But it's a meme and it attacks human brains. Here are the symptoms. This is a beneficial virus which eases the pain of dysfunctional human brains. It works especially well in middle-aged males who are paranoid about losing their jobs because the general public no longer feels threatened by the evils they are fighting. The virus reprograms said males, antivirus developers, to believe they really do have a purpose in life, that they really are knights in shining armor riding out to vanquish the world from evil. It improves the general attitude towards life. Note that these effects are accomplished in software, unlike the effects of Prozac, which are accomplished in hardware. Politically incorrect, This virus definitely is, because you can no longer get a letter, a well-written letter, about a virus scare published in a major city newspaper. Since the Michelangelo fiasco, the media has concluded quite correctly that virus scares are more hype than reality. So they won't publish anything about them. So there I kind of have three choices. Who should get first prize? I'm kind of inclined to give Bob Bales, the director of the NCSA, the first prize. What do you think?
Yeah.
Okay. I think he gets it. Is Win Schwartz out here? There he is. Would you pass that info on to Bob? Tell him to give me a call and claim his prize? Yeah, let's read what the prize here is. He wrote the Don Quixote. Prizes. The winner will get worldwide fame and recognition, a cash prize of $100 US, a year's subscription to Computer Virus Developments Quarterly. His virus will be published in Computer Virus Developments Quarterly and other fine journals. He will get an engraved plaque recognizing his contribution to the betterment of mankind. And a copy of our great CD. Okay, so Bob Bales is the winner. Number two, I guess it's going to be the Pro-AL virus. What's it do? Well, it attacks antivirus programs, and it sometimes leaves little messages for you after you've executed a program. We'll publish it and make it available in Computer Virus Developments Quarterly, this coming issue, which should be out at the end of August. I don't know if Stormbringer is here. I kind of don't think so. But he gets a CD. And third place, since the tax break wasn't implemented, I can't give an award for it. If anybody wants to implement it, don't tell me you did. But if it happens to show up in my mail, I wouldn't mind taking a look at it. Thanks.